Online presents Just Love, a conversation on the church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world, and we just say just love, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. We are in this season of Lent, the season which we talk about repentance, conversion. I've gotten a new take on Lent this year. I think we should be much more upbeat during Lent because this is an opportunity that we're given to change, to make things different, to make ourselves different, and making ourselves different, then we kind of do our part to make those closest to us better and make our world a better place. So I've begun to kind of talk about Lent not primarily as a time of great somberness and sacrifice and penance and fasting, but I've talked about the end of that, which is basically the transformation of trying to be better people, trying to be better with ourselves, better with our neighbors, with our world, and better with our God. Now, I kind of think that that's a pretty good thing. So I'm kind of looking at Lent as an upbeat season rather than one where we are kind of always down and looking, etc. And again, you always get into this Christian mystery from a variety of different perspectives. I mean, if you begin with the resurrection, you begin on a high note, but you got to get to the crucifixion because that's the way that Jesus got to the resurrection, by suffering, dying. And if you begin with the crucifixion, you got to get to the resurrection because it's not the end of the story. So one of the riches of our Christian faith is that all of the mysteries ultimately wind up being related to each other, and that's why you can kind of get into them in the way that is most accessible to you, but you can't stop at the place that's only kind of accessible to you. You got to kind of probe a little bit to get beyond that to the area that encompasses all of it. So this week is Fashion Week. And it's Fashion Week, I think it's time, it's Fashion Week, I mean, the big celebrations are in New York, right, were they of Fashion Week?
This is, this is the New York Fashion Week, right. I would say, Monsignor. Yeah, I say this is when...
I know, we talk to people throughout the world, but, you know, okay, we'll give a little bit of a bow. There's a Parish Fashion Week, and there are other places, too,
yes.
But, okay, so this is New York Fashion Week, and so... Today on Just Love, we're going to be speaking a little bit about fashion, but kind of alternative fashion. We're going to speak about fashion in a way that kind of looks at different ways that fashion can be used to make our world more just and to make it more compassionate. And so our two guests are going to take very different approaches to it, but they're into that way of looking at fashion from kind of an ethical point of view and from an altruistic, charitable point of view, and which I think is a very, very good kind of balance to the glitzy Fashion Week, which is kind of all over the news and all over the media. So we're going to do a little bit of a contrast of it because we're going to look at it from our, you know, our Catholic Christian perspective, where we always look at how what's going on in the world has some ethical implications, how it deals with the dignity of the human person, and those types of things. So kind of before we get into that, Tom, is there any news that we want to speak about?
Well, one of the things I think, Monsieur, we had mentioned it's Fashion Week, and obviously, yes, you know, sometimes us New Yorkers think we're center of the world, but as you said, there's other fashion weeks and there's other fashion things that go on in other parts of the world. And so in the Diocese of Tulsa, Monsignor, Catholic Charities out there and their Catholic Youth Ministry programs is this week holding their beautiful fashion show and dinner. Now, beautiful, the way they spell it is beyoutiful. And what it's for is for girls ages the 5th through the 12th grade. And what they do is they bring in speakers to kind of talk about the importance of girls' education, the importance of girls' self-esteem. And they really have young women kind of get up and kind of do a fashion show and almost like a little mini Miss America show, talk about things that are important to them. And it's really just very affirming and very esteeming. So as you said, there are other parts of the world that celebrate fashion in maybe a less glitzy way than New York, but I think certainly in a totally wholesome way.
Good. Well, okay, Tom. So having kind of given us a little bit of input as how people are looking at things, let's go to our first guest, who is Kirsten Dickerson, who's the founder and the CEO of Raven and Lily, which is a fair trade store. And let's talk about her take on fashion and her take on kind of creating gifts and accessories and clothing with natural fabrics and locally sourced eco-friendly material. Kirsten Dickerson, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great. You actually, for the past, almost a little bit less than a decade, have been working at Raven and Lily in this particular project. But before that, you spent a number of years in the film industry, and you were kind of doing styling work in the film industry. Did I get that right?
Yes, I actually, the day after I graduated from college, I actually hopped on a plane and went to volunteer with Mother Teresa when she was still alive. And that was back in 1996. And so since then, I've been traveling the world doing two things. One is volunteering with nonprofits and really trying to learn a lot about poverty issues and how to work among women and children and be an advocate for them. But at the same time, I married my best friend from college who's a filmmaker, and I did a lot of styling and art direction for the film industry, both in Northern California as well as Los Angeles, because he introduced me to that world, and I have a creative design background as well. So there were two different things I was very involved in, and those worlds collided when I started Raven and Lily. It was seeing firsthand the trend of training women and design skills emerging around the world through some of my travels, and then having those connections specifically in Los Angeles to a lot of designers, and really seeing that I could come alongside those nonprofit efforts and really help provide design input in a market for groups of women who were learning design skills but really needed the opportunity to turn that into sustainable income for their families and their community.
Well, that sounds great. That sounds kind of fascinating. So tell us kind of how you do what you do now. I mean, you've been in this with Raven and Lily for about 8 years. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the company and give us an overview of what the company's about and what you're doing with it.
Sure. Well, the mission statement for Raven and Lily is that Raven and Lily is an ethical fashion brand that's dedicated to empowering women through design. And what that means is that we currently come alongside 19 artisan partnerships in 10 countries, and we collaborate with groups of women that have specific design skills, and we design here in our Austin-based studio to the skills of those women, utilizing local eco-friendly materials. And then we sell everything under the Raven and Lily brand. So everything is an exclusive Raven and Lily design. So when we launch a collection, like yesterday, we actually launched our Spring 16 collection. And everything that you see looks like a cohesive collection, but it actually represents the work of over 1,500 women in all these countries that we are collaborating with. So something might be eco-dyed silk. It might be hand-embroidered. It might be wooden leather, it may be upcycled brass jewelry. There's all different kinds of materials and skills we work with, but we design so that there's a cohesive look and theme and color story across the world for our collections. But each material and each part of that collection represents one of these groups of women that we're working with.
So you kind of work in a collaborative way with the women who are producing the clothing, producing the accessories. It's kind of you're kind of working on it together with them?
Yes. I call it a partnership because we do not own any of the artisan groups we work with. They are self-sustaining businesses that exist within each country. We actually work in the U.S. as well as Guatemala, Peru, Pakistan, India, Cambodia, Malaysia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. And we're starting partnerships in Haiti as well. So those are all the places that we're working. And those groups were either artisans that have skills that have been passed down for centuries amongst their people, and usually those are going to be the more traditional Maasai that we work with in Kenya or the women in the rainforest in Guatemala. So there's some really amazing traditional artisan skills, but they just had no market access and no modern design input to be able to take that to a broader market. So we work with groups like that to help turn something beautiful that they've been doing into something that could become income generating.
Again, that struck something in me, and so correct me if I'm wrong. I know it's very different, But a number of years ago, I think I heard some similar model that the Italian company Bennington.
Yes.
I think they kind of worked with groups of people who were doing work in various areas, but didn't have the capacity to bring it to market. And they kind of served as kind of the branding marketing company for small groups of workers throughout Italy. Did I remember that right?
I actually am not familiar with that. It would be really interesting to know. I mean, it sounds similar to what we're doing. One of the things that does make Ravenwilly different is that we're actually a benefit corporation, a B corporation, which means that we have the highest level of accountability as a company with a lot of transparency. So when we say we do something, we go through pretty extensive certification and audit processes.
Well, that might be interesting for our listeners to know. I'm not familiar with what it means to be a B corporation.
Yes, it's actually not widely known still, but it's a growing, emerging trend in business. And when I started Ravenwilly, we were actually a nonprofit from 2008 to 2011. And as I did research on the most sustainable way to grow the company so that I could help employ as many women as possible, I started learning about B Corp, and it was quite small back then. And other companies that you're probably more familiar with that are B Corps are like Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream and Seventh Generation. Those are some of the larger companies.
Now, is a B Corporation a designation under the IRS tax code?
It's a designation legally, but it doesn't affect your taxes. So we're still taxed as a S Corp, but the entity itself means that in my bylaws, I'm registered as a B Corp, and my bylaws speak to the mission of the company.
Right.
And I have to exist for a public benefit.
Ah.
And that benefit for Ravenwilly is to help alleviate poverty among women and to use fashion as a means of making a positive impact on people on the planet, not a negative impact.
Oh, that's interesting. I thank you, because I didn't know that. That really strikes me as something that is kind of worth knowing more about and seeing which companies kind of fall into that category.
You could go to bcorporation.net and find out. There's actually a report card on the companies that are certified, and you can learn a lot.
Kirsten, we're speaking with Kirsten Dickerson, who is the founder, the CEO of Raven and Lily, which is a fair trade store, and it sells jewelry, clothing, accessories, and its primary and it has naturally dyed fabrics, and it's locally sourced, and it's eco-friendly materials. So, Kirsten, how big is the company? How big have you grown? I mean, it's a company. What's your volume of sales? How are you doing as a business?
Well, I think very encouraging actually, because there's a growing trend with this idea of ethical fashion. While we do have a storefront in Austin, and I'm opening a second storefront, the goal will be to open up multiple brick and mortars over the next few years, but primarily our sales have been online and through wholesale accounts across the world for the last 4 or 5 years. And when I started and moved into the for-profit model in 2011 as a social business, since then we've actually grown 1,000%, and that's a lot of growth. And we, year over year, are growing about 70% right now each year. And we started with a handful of about 70 women, and we now help employ over 1,500. So that just gives you an idea of it's growing. And I think what's encouraging about it is just as the farm-to-table movement and the slow food movement has grown so much over the past 10 years, and it's become a known thing, and across our country people are more eager to support restaurants that follow those practices, to support farmers' markets, to shop organic. Fashion is one of the next areas that movement is happening. Some people refer to it as slow fashion, but that idea of asking those hard questions, who made my clothes and how were my clothes made, is starting to emerge on the consumer mind in the West. And then companies like Ravenwilly are emerging that will have a positive answer to those questions and are part of what's known as the slow fashion and ethical fashion movement.
What is slow fashion?
I'm sorry, say again?
What's slow fashion?
Slow fashion means that it's not being mass-produced in factories and sweatshops where there isn't accountability for how the production practices are affecting people on the planet negatively. The opposite is fast fashion, which is a super popular way for Westerners to shop because we are used to having things quick and fast. It's like kind of equal within the food industry to the fast food chains and McDonald's and that sort of thing. The opposite would be slow fashion, whereas a company like Ravenwilly are working with a lot of other companies that are emerging where they're being very thoughtful about knowing the practices, really honoring handmade artisan skills, being held to high level of, levels of accountability to knowing how you're impacting the planet through your production practices, and very much being dedicated to having direct relationships with the people producing to ensure there's no child labor, that the people are being paid with livable wages and health care access and safe conditions and all the things that, you know, honestly, as a Christian, you should we should value, because we recognize that we are connected to people in the world. But I think as consumers, we often don't have to think about it. And slow fashion is that movement saying we should think about it. We actually have the power of choice. And as Westerners, we have so much more choice than so many people in the world, and we can use our power of choice for good in so many areas, including fashion.
Now, obviously, you formed this as a corporation, and you are very savvy in terms of businesses and things of that nature. Where do you come in on the kind of the price point in terms of selling stuff to consumers? Middle, bottom, top?
Where? We're in the middle, and then some of the more exclusive things, the middle high range. I think that we would be equal to some of the specialty stores out there, like your Anthropologie, which is a chain really popular among women. It's a lifestyle brand, and you'll find a wide range there. And that's, you know, probably our target audience, the same type of woman that would shop at a store like that. It just happens to be that everything's made by a woman and ethically produced. So we have the things that are lower price point that could be really quick pickup items that are, you know, journals and soaps and jewelry that would be, you know, under $30. But then we have some nicer things like leather bags and clothing that's over $200. It's sort of in that range. We don't have very many items over $300. Everything's under that.
We're speaking with Kirsten Dickerson, the founder and CEO of Raven and Lily, which is a fair trade store, both brick store and also online store, which is attempting to do the production of goods in a way that is very respectful. It creates a fairer world for those who are creating them. So I have a particular interest in this because 2 years ago, I went on it with a delegation to visit garment workers in Bangladesh. And we were there because there was the whole move towards create an accord in which there was a commitment to better working conditions, safer factories, all of those things in order to do that. Now, clearly, that's the fast part of the production. It's not the slow part. And so I'm real intrigued about what you're doing. But let me ask you a question, which always is the question on my mind. It may not be on other people's minds, but certainly seems to me that what you're talking about is so incredibly positive. It's good. It is. How big can it go to scale? And let me just use a regular example. I mean, can it compete with the family that's going to shop in Target for, you know, the basic stuff that they need, what they need, sweaters and blouses and things like that? Is can it get big so that we can really penetrate the market for this type of stuff in the United States?
I think that's a great question. I get asked that question a lot by investors, actually. So I think the answer is yes and no. One of the things that is different is that I'm a big advocate that we don't need as much stuff as we think we need.
Right.
We should slow down just as humans and be more thoughtful about when we spend our money and how we're spending it. So when it comes to the area of fashion and jewelry accessories, we should really buy what we love, and we should buy things that we know the story about. So I think if the answer is that, yes, we can meet consumer demand as we're growing and there's a growing awareness and other companies are emerging, I don't know that this space would ever be as big as something like a Target. Right. But what is happening is that we are actually behind the scenes while we're working with small artisan co-ops. We're also working with some of the first fair trade factories in some countries. So we have both things going on so that we can learn how do you scale production in a bigger way without compromising the mission, without compromising our ideals. So there's a factory in Africa. It's one of the first fair trade factories in all of Africa that we are partnering with. And it's in a carbon neutral zone. The children go to a school on the facility. They have healthy meals provided every day. The workers have fair trade wages. It's actually, you know, officially certified. We've gone to visit in person. And where it's located is on a wildlife refuge where they've helped to restore the land and stop poaching. And it's an amazing example of how it is possible to do something on a larger scale the right way. It took years to get there, and they've asked us to partner with them because they're ready. And it's going to be interesting because that's very scalable compared to some of our smaller artisan groups. But the smaller ones actually are growing. Like, we started with some groups of women that were maybe 10 women, and now there's 200 because our orders have grown so much. And those women just train their neighbors and their friends as they're benefiting. The first reaction they have is, how can I serve my neighbor and reach out to the other women I know that need.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you mentioned that factory in Africa. I guess it was about 3 years ago, I visited a factory in Alta Vista outside of Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. And that's a factory which is basically dedicated to providing fair wages, providing decent working conditions. And I visited the factory, and I can say the working conditions seem to me to be very, very fine, clean, etc. People were working, etc. And that's a little bit more I would say, use my words, mainstream, because a major market for what they were producing were college campuses. So they were producing sweatshirts, they were producing T-shirts, things of that nature, which were pretty ordinary stuff. But they were moving into a movement where colleges and universities wanted to not have their stuff that they were branding produced in sweatshops. So that's how that factory kind of got off the ground.
Oh, that's great. I haven't heard of that one. Yeah, I think it's both things happening behind the scenes. I'm wanting to scale Raven Lily, and we've proven that it is possible to scale, and we're always thinking about the model and the best way to grow, and at the same time trying to educate the Western consumer about, you know, being thoughtful in how you spend your money and supporting companies, not just Raven Lily, but other companies as well that are really trying to make a difference in the world and do it the right way. And it probably means that, you know, less support for some of the big box things, but it also means eventually the big box companies are going to feel the pressure, be held accountable. And I think we're going to see that happen more and more, just like you have even in Walmart, you have organic sections and things like that. That did not exist.
Now, curiosity, you mentioned investors, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Are B-Corp corporations, can they be publicly traded?
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question, but you can't have investors.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm probably not going to be a candidate for that, so it's not actually researched, but you definitely can grow and have investment.
Great. Listen, I know you have to leave, and so I'm just so grateful that you spent the time speaking with us, and I'm just absolutely delighted. And thank you for the work that you're doing, because it really is a real concrete example of how businesses can operate in a way that does advance human dignity, does advance making our world more interrelated. And I just want to thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the work you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Kirsten Dickerson, the president, the founder, the CEO of Raven and Lily, which is a fair trade store which seeks to kind of make sure that those who are producing the goods that are sold are actually being paid a fair wages, that they are able to educate their children, that they'll be able to have health care. And it's in stores throughout the United States and available online. So that's Raven and Lily. Let's just take a break. And when we come back, we'll kind of continue our conversation. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Love God. Love your neighbor. Love yourself. And our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel. Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just, more compassionate. This is Fashion Week in New York, but there's a lot going on in our world far beyond New York. The Pope's traveling, a lot of stuff going on. We're in the second week of Lent. We just had the Grammys this past week. And so a lot of stuff going on. Tom, what's some of the news that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, you had mentioned, Monsignor, obviously, that the Pope has been in Mexico. And he did a lot of stuff while he was down there, Monsignor. He spoke to civic officials and he talked to them about basically trying to have them secure the good of all. He talked to them about corruption, about the drug trade that happens down in Mexico. He talked to the people of Mexico themselves when he gathered in front of 500,000 people. And he basically told them to turn their nation into a land of opportunity where there will be no need to emigrate in order to dream, no need to be exploited in order to work, and no need to make despair and poverty
of the many. Just stop for a second, Tom. Mm-hmm. I think in some of the world that we live in, is that what the Pope has just said about making Mexico a land of opportunity. The reality is that Mexico has become a place of a great deal of opportunity. And in fact, in recent years, contrary to what you hear in a lot of different places, the net migration from Mexico to the United States has been about zero. In fact, as many people going back as are coming. And so when they talk about securing the border, the fact is that the border is pretty secure right now. That doesn't mean perfect. That doesn't mean people in. But the reality is that because of some of the economic changes, the people are finding more opportunities in Mexico. And that's not to in any way make light of the continuing drug violence, the continuing issues there that put people's lives at stake. But a little bit of fact check would be helpful in understanding kind of what's going on. So, Tom, sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's fine, Monsieur. You're right. And in fact, Mexico, in a sense, as you had mentioned, is as you said, is becoming a land of opportunity itself. In fact, so much so that some of the folks who are kind of leaving some particularly violent and poor situations in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are entering Mexico. And actually, the people of San Cristobal de las Casas, the diocese that's in the really southern part of Mexico in the area of Chiapas, what they did is they held a collection before Pope Francis came. And on Monday, he was down in Chiapas, the Pope, and he said Mass for the people there. And they donated funds from this collection in order to be able to build two additional youth hostels for the young people who are leaving Honduras, who are leaving El Salvador, who are leaving Guatemala, so that they would have a place in order to be able to, as the Pope said, heal the balm of these feet that do all this emigrating and all this walking. And they turned the money over to the Pope, but the Pope didn't bring it back to Rome. What he did was he obviously gave it back to that diocese, and he said it was a wonderful thing to see in the year of mercy. So
it's good. That is a wonderful example of kind of solidarity, a wonderful example of compassion in trying to deal with alleviating some of the suffering that's going on in the world. Anything else, Tom?
Sure. You mentioned the Grammy Awards, Monsignor. Now, you know, it's very interesting, but one of the things, and I know we were talking to our first guest, Kirsten, and she was talking a little bit about the work in Africa. Well, you know, there was kind of a story that was circulating before the Grammy about a band from Malawi in Africa. And this band is based in the Zomba prison. It was a group of 14 prisoners and two guards who lived and worked in the maximum security Zomba prison in Malawi. And they released an album called I Have No Everything Here. And it was a collection of songs on topics such as missing children and the missing of their children while they were incarcerated. Some of them wrote songs about their longing for loss, for sin, for forgiveness. And they put it together with contemporary African themes, and they put it forward. And it was up for a Grammy for Best World Music. Now, it didn't win. Actually, the actual Best World Music, unfortunately, the Best World Music went to Angelique Kidjo, who's another very famous African performer. However, the Zamba Band has brought much needed attention to Malawi. And just for our listeners to know, Monsignor, it was just reported last week by Fides News, which is released by the Holy See, that Malawi, which is a population of about 16 million people, is currently undergoing a drought. And there's almost 3 million people, Monsignor. There's 2.8 million people who are at current risk of their crops failing and of there being a major drought in that country. So just to be aware of that and to see how, even though sometimes we have these terrible things that happen, there is always good things that happen in these countries too, and there's things to celebrate, and even though people are in hard situations, they're still doing wonderful things like making music. So
our next guest, Rachel O'Neill, who founded Little Dresses for Africa, I think she began that because of a trip that she made to Malawi.
She did,
so,
yes, right.
So there's a little tie-in there. Mm-hmm. You know, Tom, isn't this week also in the Pope's trip to Mexico, isn't he also celebrating Mass? He celebrated Mass, I believe, at the border with the United States, didn't he?
He did, yes. He did that back on Wednesday, Monsignor. I would say he celebrated Mass there. And, you know, where he did was he went up to the area. It's called Ciudad Juarez, that's located on the border, the U.S. border with Mexico. And in 2010, I think what's important to remember is how dangerous Ciudad Juarez is. I mean, back in 2010, it was first labeled by the media the murder capital of the world. And you may remember, Monsignor, we had a guest on Just Love a number of years ago who spoke about the tremendous number of women that disappeared in that area. So I think it was very appropriate that the Pope went up and said Mass in that area. I think it was very appropriate. We had a number of bishops from our country who attended that Mass and concelebrated with him. And I think it was wonderful sense of solidarity about how Ciudad Juarez, which is a scene of so much violence, could also be the scene of such solidarity. I think that's a very important thing, too.
Well, and again, I think the Mass was celebrated right at the border.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a very, very poignant kind of celebration of the Eucharist, which raises the issue of borders, raises the issue of humanitarian stuff. And again, I mentioned the fact that this is something that is critically important. It certainly has been a very, very high priority in Pope Francis. I mean, while Pope Francis has continually talked about us needing to be aware of the needs of the poor, I would suggest that of all the areas of poverty and all of those people who are impacted by that, he probably has placed a higher priority on refugees and immigrants than almost any other group. Not that he hasn't said things about those who are hungry, not that those who need housing, but he really, really seems to raise up the issue of migrants. And I think, well, he should, because we're in a world right now where I'm told there are, you know, 40, 50, 60 million displaced persons. Now, again, a little technically, which our listeners may know, that, you know, most of those are displaced within their own country. So, for example, because of the history of the drug trafficking and the drug lords in Colombia, that country has almost 6 million displaced people, which means that they were forced out of where they were living. They live in another part of Colombia. And so there are a lot of displaced people, millions upon millions. But there are also millions of refugees who have to actually leave their own country to go to other countries. And that's such a very, very important issue. And it's become a very controversial issue because of terrorism. And in fact, that people, I think, rightly are concerned that there not be violence and bombings in different places. But at the same time, how do we be a welcoming people? How do we provide for those who need relief from a fear of violence and persecution from where they come. I'll just mention something that was in the media this past within the past week, which is kind of, again, a sadness in my world for what was there. There was somebody who took a billboard ad in Minnesota, St. Cloud, Minnesota, which basically said Catholic Charities resettles Islamists. And then ask the question, is that evil or is it insanity? And very interestingly, and again, I do point this out because, you know, people just are so emotional about these things and facts don't get in the way. So, in fact, in St. Cloud, the Catholic Charities there doesn't resettle anybody. It's not part of the refugee resettlement program. And so when Catholic Charities of St. Cloud pointed that out, well, they wound up taking the billboard down. Now, it cost probably, you know, $1,000. They give a range of how much it cost to put up that billboard. But for $1,000, you can really put some very extreme language up there. You can create atmospheres that is so very negative, so very biased in ways. Now, while it was taken down there, I mean, the reality is that Catholic Charities throughout the country do resettle refugees. And they resettle refugees of all religions. So there are resettled Christians. There are resettled Muslims. There are resettled people of all different religions that are part of that resettlement process. And it's part of the mission of Catholic Charities to be that welcoming arm of doing it. And again, to think that it's just done without any type of attention, without any type of screening, is just simply wrong. And there's screening goes on all the time to make sure that, first of all, that those who are saying that they need asylum, they need a refugee status, that it's legitimate, that in fact there is a real founded fear of persecution if they were to go back to their own country. And secondly, that there aren't some collateral issues associated with those individuals that could provide, that could be dangerous in where they're moving in. Now, so that's kind of part of the whole process. So I think the Pope going to the border there raises us up, but it reminds us that in our own country, there's a lot of negative talk, a lot of extreme talk about that. And, you know, my own opinion is that denouncing that talk is not as helpful as trying to engage it, to understand it, to try to transform that extreme into something that is much more productive. And I also believe that what Catholic Charities has to do is, rather than giving a lot of speeches, is to kind of do things, to welcome refugees, to show that they can be part of our community and productive and helpful and make our communities even more vibrant. So with that, let's take a break before we go to our next guest, who is Rachel O'Neill. We'll be back in just a minute or two. This is Just Love, our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and we'll be a better world. Join us when we come back on Sirius XM, the Catholic Channel, 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is Fashion Week in New York, and it's a big deal here. And in fact, because of some of the splashiness of the week, it kind of does make the media throughout the country in a variety of ways. But we're taking a little bit of an alternative view on fashion this week. We're speaking about how people can use fashion to make our world better, to make it more just, make it more compassionate, whether it is running a business, as we just finished speaking to with Kirsten Dickerson, who's the founder and CEO of Raven and Lily, or in a minute we're going to speak with Rachel O'Neill, who deals with the altruistic part of fashion in how people without enough clothes are helped by their fellow human beings to have sufficient clothing. And, you know, it's interesting because fashion is a big splashy business, but it's also something that all of us need to do. Everybody needs a shirt. Everybody needs clothes in order to live and to work. And, you know, especially if you live in certain parts of our country, because of the seasons, you need fashion. You need clothes that are warm clothes, cool clothes, medium clothes, etc. And so fashion or garments or clothing is basically something that all of us deal with as just simply the part of getting through each day, getting through the week, getting through our year. So it's something you can't avoid. I mean, this week, when we look at Fashion Week, we deal with the glitz of it and we deal with the very high-end stuff. But there is a reality to clothing and fashion that is just part of the routine, part of everyday life. So let's speak with Rachel O'Neill, who is the founder of Little Dresses for Africa. Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. So, okay. So my first question, Rachel, is who goes on their 50th birthday to Africa?
I guess somebody who's avoiding black balloons and over the hill signs.
Okay. All right. So how'd you decide to go to Africa?
Well, I've always been drawn to Africa. I love the music, the textures, the sounds, the colors, the people. I was just really drawn to it my whole life, and it just seemed like a good, I guess, rite of passage for me. So,
was that your first trip to Africa?
It was, in fact. It was a holiday, but it was there that I fell in love with the people and the continent, and I knew I'd be back. Definitely.
Ah, so, okay. But, you know, I got to say, it took you a while to get there.
Well, I was raising kids and you know, doing life. And sometimes you have to wait for these things. But, boy, when it gets there, it comes in full force, I'm telling you.
Hey, you know, I was talking to somebody just a couple weeks ago. And I was talking to him, and he told me that he kind of has been a world traveler with his family. And he took his kids when they were like 8 or 9 to these really exotic places in Asia and all over the world. And that was kind of part of their kind of trip to do it. But so tell us about your first trip to Africa, to Uganda.
Well, my first trip, like I said, was a holiday, and we saw the country, and it was just beautiful, and it was very comfortable, especially looking at the trips that I take now. But I had an opportunity to go back about 12 or 14 months later to serve with a mission group in Malawi, and it was there that I observed how hard the women worked and how the little girls, you know, worked taking care and getting the food ready and preparing it for hours over an open fire. And then when it was time to eat, they quickly went to the back of the line and they were in these little tattered clothing. And I'm like, doggone it, they've been working so hard. Why do they have to go last? And I just remember saying to my friend that day, I wish there was some way that I could honor these little girls and let them know that they're valuable and in some way say, hey, you're worthy. And I said, when I come back, and I knew I would be back, I said, I'm going to bring some little dresses and I'm going to give them to these girls and I am going to just try to honor them, even if it was just for a minute. But basically, that simple idea just took off like crazy. And of course, now it's much more than clothing.
So that's a wonderful kind of one-on-one human interest story. So how did you get from that to now a full-blown organization called Dresses for Africa?
Well, I sometimes wonder. I actually had a goal of sending 1,000 dresses, but the complication was that I don't even sew.
A minor thing.
But I have a lot of dedicated people in my life and a lot of people that wanted to help. And
hey, do you remember that? You remember that book, Huckleberry Finn?
Yeah.
Seems like that. You didn't do the work. You got everybody else to do it.
Maybe so. I don't know. It takes all of us, though. You know, some people donate material. Some people sew. Some people pack. Some people write checks for the shipping costs. You know, it just takes everybody. And I guess I'm a good organizer because our goal of 1,000 dresses has turned into really close to 5 million dresses that have gone to 81 countries.
Yeah, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's been crazy. That's a lot of little girls. And of course, now we also take breeches for boys, and we've identified some needs through these dresses that we've been able to meet because of our love for the people there.
Now, are all those dresses kind of home sewn?
Yeah, they're home sewn by people all over. I used to say the U.S., but now we actually have collection and distribution points in other countries like Portugal, Brazil, Italy, France. It's just the U.K. So they're coming from all over now. And then we send them with mission groups that are going, and they actually pass them out on our behalf. And that way the word is spread. That way more children can benefit, and just not one village, you know, ends up getting everything. So we really spread it across the world this way, and it works out really well.
That is a huge, huge number. How many years have you been doing this for?
11. So now you know I'm 61.
Okay. All right.
I'm just kidding.
Well, you sound like about 31.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Okay.
So, and which countries are actually kind of benefiting? Which girls in?
Well, we all over. We have actually given them to 46 countries in the on the continent of Africa, and then other countries like Honduras, Haiti, and even here in the U.S. as well. But our home office, or I say office, it's not an office, but our home village is in Malawi, which is East Africa. And that's where we have a distribution building that we built. And it's in a very rural setting. And that way we can send containers to ourselves. So we send a 40-foot container with textbooks and Bibles, and of course, millions in dresses and breeches and bicycles and just anything that could possibly help.
So let me ask you, were you rooting for the Malawi group at the Grammys?
I was, in fact.
They didn't win, huh?
That's okay. They got some notice, and that's good.
Yeah, that is good.
It was really exciting to see because, you know, a lot of people didn't even know where Malawi was before. You know, Madonna got her baby there, and it's beginning to get a little bit of attention. But it is one of the most oppressed countries in Africa, and so we try to emphasize that because it's not easy to get to. It's a difficult trip to get there, and so we do want to really work with the people that need it the most.
That's in the eastern part of Africa, isn't it?
It is. It borders Mozambique and Tanzania, Zambia. It's actually about the size of New Jersey. It's a little tiny strip right in the middle. It's landlocked, but it has 17 million people, and 90% of them are in the rural villages. So it's definitely in need. And so when we go in, we use these dresses as a way to get into their homes and encourage them, teach them simple lessons on clean water, sanitation, nutrition. And then we identify what we can in each village and try to meet those needs with clean water, a primary school, and then a community building. Those are the three things, because we know we can't do everything.
So tell our listeners again those three areas that you concentrate on.
Clean water. We try to put in a well in one of the villages that we adopt, because clean water saves lives immediately. And of course, it helps with sanitation and the stop of disease. And it also keeps kids in school, believe it or not, because they don't have to spend their day carrying water. They can actually get the water from the well.
Hey, speaking of clean water, how far is Brownstone, Michigan from Flint, Michigan?
Oh, quite a ways, about maybe an hour.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah, our water's fine here, thank God.
Okay.
And then the second thing we concentrate on is primary school, because the children are not allowed to go to secondary school without a certificate of completion from the primary school. And so if you've got orphans or child-headed families, they spend their whole time going to get water, or they're not as disciplined enough to know the importance of education unless the school is really conveniently located. And then by the time they do realize education is important, they're big and they don't want to go to the primary schools, and therefore they don't get their letter of completion, and so they drop out of school altogether. So we think that's a missing link, and so we try to provide primary education. And then the third thing is a community center, and it's not, you know, don't picture the YMCA. We're talking about a very simple little structure with open sides and a roof, and it's where they can meet to worship. They can meet together to exchange information. They can be protected from the hot sun or the rainy season. So we just try to concentrate on those three things.
Hey, Rachel O'Neill, the founder of Little Dresses for Africa, thanks so much for what you're doing. And thanks for taking the time to share with our listeners how kind of a really profound Christian spirit, first of all, can reach out across oceans to express solidarity, and how simple acts like providing dresses for can lead into other things that really can foster the dignity of the human person. So, Rachel, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love. But that's minor. Thanks even more for what you're doing to kind of make our world more compassionate. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Well, you know, Tom, I think we did a great job, if I have to say so, in putting the right perspective on garments and fashion. I mean, the glitz of fashion is all over the media. And in fact, I had to go to a benefit last night for a particular group, and it was a black tie event, and there was a lot of fashionable gowns that were there. But today we've spoken about people who really kind of make a major contribution to kind of making our world a better place, both just and compassionate, in the corporation that has provided maybe 1,500 or so jobs for people in developing worlds and running that company in a way that is trying to meet high ethical standards. And then with just a simple kind of compassionate outpouring of the concern for people in another country. So thank you for being with us this week on Just Love, our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world and how it relates to our values and our ethics. Join us again next week on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.